Okay, welcome back, and it's going to be a grand hour we get to spend with John Barber again. Hello, Johnny. How is it in Las Vegas?
Well, you'll know how it is when I read to you this Facebook post I put up yesterday. It says, then you'll know how I feel physically. The rest of it is something else. Pardon this 8-year-old innocent boy that still lives in me for asking this obvious question of all the scientists and weather experts that have been telling me for years that the Earth is warming. Today, in Las Vegas, it is about the second straight month of below freezing wind chill factors and howling winds, today blowing snow and hail. It has been absolutely the most miserable, coldest 2 months I have spent in my 25 years in Las Vegas. So cold that when I spit, it bounces off the sidewalk as ice. So.
Oh, come on.
My
come on.
Question to the experts is this. When do you take these frigging temperatures about the Earth's warming? In Las Vegas in July?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Jeff, every day I would want to go to Boulder Creek Golf Course and play 9 holes. I have not been able to get out of the house for 2 months because of the freezing weather. So if you came in my house today, you would see all of Sarita's best glasses and cups lying all over the floors in this house so that I could putt.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Well, good for you. Todd, can you turn Johnny way up, please? I'm maxed here, and I'm hardly getting any.
Hang on. Can you hear me better now? Can you hear me better now?
That's better, yeah. Well, something happened, and you're okay now. Thanks.
Oh, okay. So, anyway, Sarita's was worried that I was going to break some glasses and cups, but I'm such a lousy putter. Nothing has happened.
Well, she sees you with a driver in your hand. She better grab her cups and run.
Oh, my God. It's just been totally miserable. Anyway, you and I never, I just love talking with you and being on your show. And you and I never hide anything from your wonderful audience. So why don't you tell them about the short email that I sent you early in the week about the possibility of either appearing or not appearing on your show tonight?
Well, Johnny sent me an email, and he basically said, I'm going to paraphrase it. It's been several days since I read it, a couple days anyway, that he was figuring that he'd been on the program for 10 or 11 years, and you know he was getting to the point where he was worried that he was running out of things to share with everyone, stories to tell. And I jumped on him. I said, are you kidding me? You could talk forever. Stories, vignettes, recounting amazing encounters with people. Come on. Well, so anyway, he thought it might be time for him to retire from doing the program. That is not going to be allowed to happen.
Well, a couple of things. You responded with a very interesting question because I said, you know, I'll leave it up to you, Jeff, because I owe you a lot. And unlike most people I know, anybody who has ever done me a kindness or a favor, I treasure for the rest of my life, okay? And you're one of the very few who has done that. So, but you sent back an interesting reply. You asked me if there were some forces that were asking me not to do your show. Do you recall that?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah,
A little bit of a soap opera comment, but... I just worried that somebody was pressing on you to stop doing the program.
Well, only one person has. He's one of my very dearest friends. I won't name who he is. I'll just tell you, he is a major domo in the sports business in America. And I won't tell you what sport because it might be easy to track him down. He comes into Las Vegas once every 3 months, invites me to lunch or dinner. He has bought all of my books. Mm-hmm. He's bought the movies. He is one of my very biggest fans. He just got married in a synagogue a few months ago. And he said, John, I'm not a speaker. I'm a sports person. Could you do me a favor? And I said, whatever you want. Whatever you want. He said, would you write my wedding speech for me? And I said, of course, because if you're in a synagogue and you're not making Jews laugh, you're not very good. So
that's funny.
I wrote it. I wrote it for him. He was a bigger hit than the bride and the band. He was so, so grateful. But so every once in a while, I post on my Facebook, it's that time of the month. I love that phrase. It's that time of the month that I'm going to be on Jim Brent's show. But he will never listen to me. And I said, why aren't you listening to me? I said, because I don't know what I'm going to say. Jeff doesn't know what I'm going to say, but it is often really fun and informative. He said, well, I hear he's an anti-Semite. I said, you didn't hear it from Jeff, did you? He said, no, because I don't listen to him. I said, well, listen to him one day when I'm not on, and you'll find out he's not saying anything anti-Semitic. He said, but I hear it from a lot of my Jewish friends. And I said, well, your Jewish friends are misinforming you. I said, because let me tell you something. I listened to Jeff Rentz, and you know, he tells us about the fact that the state of Israel is the only country in the world that does not have clearly defined borders, which are constantly being expanded by taking tanks and going into Palestinian territory that is not theirs, running over the homes and killing the people. It is the only country in the world that won't sign the Nuclear Anti-Proliferation Treaty. And one of their scientists 9 years ago told the London Times that they had 87 A-bombs, and they stuck him in solitary confinement for 10 years. I said, we send $30 million a day, Jeff points out, a day to Israel, not a nickel to Palestinians, and just a few bucks for the homeless in America. And I said, there are now, I won't mention his name, I said, there are now so many homeless tent cities in America that the post office is going to start giving them zip codes. I said, so when I listen to Jeff talk about this, I don't say that sounds anti-Semitic to me. What it sounds like to me is bloody good journalism. Okay. So, and the other thing is in 92 and 93, when I did the first Garrison tapes, in spite of standing ovations in the two or three theaters it played in and rave reviews in the LA Times, no one would distribute it. And only three people in North America would show it or talk about it. In the first one with George Knapp on his Sunday show in Las Vegas, but he was ordered by George Noory, who owns the time slot, never to have me on again. So listen, and George is my second best friend in town, so I never pushed him again, and he wants to preserve his job. The other two are Len Osanek, who does Black Op Radio in Vancouver, my second closest friend in Vancouver. And of course, the major one was Jeff Rentz. And so I went on, I guess it must have been a dozen years ago, and I said, of course, how many years can you talk about Jim Garrison or John Kennedy or the government and all the other sidebar interesting stories about the assassination? Mm-hmm. I said, and I don't know all of them, but I do know all about Jim Garrison. And I ran out of things to say about that. And so I had to start talking about show business. So I spent 8 years telling show business stories, and Jeff finally said, hey, this has to be put into a book. And he kept nagging me to put it into a book. And I said, it's the book that you love. You're telling all your friends to read. And so that's what I did. And by the way, I have the book in front of me. So he said, well, the next time you're on Jeff Rentz, I will listen. But the reason, Jeff, that I was a little reluctant to do the show is that on April 24th, it's going to be my 90th birthday. And Stu Shostak, who is my webmaster and a genius, the only guy in America who preserves classic television, and he considers me a major force of classic television, primarily because of Real People and all the other shows I did in L.A., he and I are working on doing a special live show on my birthday down there. So I was all wrapped up in doing with that. And I put a pause on it for a while, and I said, oh, yeah, because this popped up. Do you remember KHJ Channel 9 in Los
Angeles? Bill Welch?
Yeah, in Los Angeles.
Bill Welch, of course I do.
Okay, and it's right next to Paramount or RKO or someplace like that. In any event, I had forgotten.
No, Bill Welch was on, wait. Bill Welch was on KTTV. I think he was on 11.
Yeah, he was on 11.
Yes, Channel 9, KHJ. I do certainly remember that. There were some good programs on there, yeah.
Yeah, Nat King Cole's wife had a wonderful show there. Regis Philbin was on there for a while. And I had forgotten that a fellow named Walt Baker, who was the program director and a huge fan, who called me and said, would I come on and do a live Friday night show? So I had no offers to do anything else, so I did. And I forgot I had done the show entirely. And there were only four of us working on the show, Sarita, my son Christopher, and a fellow named Hal Parrots. And the reason I hired Hal Parrots is because when I did It's Tough to Be White, there were only two people who would put me on television, and one was Hal Parrots, the producer of the Joe Pine Show. So he's in his 50s and nobody would hire him. So I hired him. And the show was a smash. And there's just four of us. And, you know, because, you know, Mark Twain said the two luckiest days of your life are the day you're born and the day you discover why. And isn't that wonderful?
That's a great line. Yeah.
Yes. And I didn't discover why until I was about 17. And the why was the night that I started to watch Jack Parr. By far, greatest late night talk shows. He was intelligent and charming and funny. And I didn't know people to talk to one another. I just thought they threw beer bottles at one another or cussed one another. And the reason I became a comic is because he opened the show doing a monologue. That's how simple it was, okay? And I became a very successful comic, which led to all these other things that I did. But in any event, when I got this show, we did not have a studio audience. But I always did an opening monologue, and I did it with a blackboard. And I wrote some of the stuff on the blackboard so I could engage the audience. These blackboard monologues, at least two or three or four of them, are the funniest monologues ever spoken on American television. And that is saying a lot, okay?
Yes, it is.
And so I said to Stu, you know, Stu, what I think one of the things I've wanted to do for 45 years, because the greatest thing to me is watching a solitary performer, man or woman on stage, doing a one-person show.
A one-person show,
greatest was Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain tonight. And I said, listen, I think I could out Mark Twain. And he chuckled and I says, not that I'm a better writer, but I have better video and I have better pictures. So he said to me, he said, well, you have two problems. And I said, what? You found all this new material that you have, which is hundreds of hours. You already have hundreds of hours. How are you going to boil down a couple of hundred hours of great material into 90 minutes for a show? And I said, I don't know. He said, I think that's an impossibility. He said, what you may want to do is you may want to take this material and see if you can create a show that you could, a half hour show, just a half hour to make it punchy and short and fast.
Got it.
And we could put it up as a podcast, maybe beginning in May. Think about that. And so what I did is not only did I think about it, the title came up immediately. Pardon me for this vanity. The title of the show is America's Greatest Storyteller is a Canadian. And I had Len Osanek edit together the opening that I wrote. And the first show, as it has me, as Stu said, what you have to do, you have this, let's say one of his favorite interviews with one of the stars I had was Burt Reynolds. And I have to tell you a great story about that from when I'm done with this. And that's a wonderful show because that's a show you had Brian Gumbel on as your co-host, and you did 5 minutes of the history of his hairdos. And he says it's hilarious. But what you do with, he said, what you do at the top of the show is show yourself now. You're going to be 90, okay? But this is some of the work that I've done, and this is what why Burt Reynolds showed up, and this is why I hired Brian Gumbel. And then at the end, you do a recap of what happened to them and what happened, and then you sign off with one of your funny lines, like, you know, you can lead people from the to the facts, but you can't make them drink. That's one of the funniest things he thought I said. I said, yeah. So I made a pilot, and it is fantastic. So that's what I'm thinking about.
It worked out. You did it. It worked out. You got something down.
So, but I don't know anything about podcasts. I don't know how to make money from a show. But a friend of mine, Blair Murdoch, I did a show in the 90s in Vancouver called The Liars Club, which I hosted, and I was one of the contestants. I was one of the panelists in the show, and the guy who is Kiss, the big singer in Kiss.
Gene Simmons.
Yeah, married to a really sexy woman. Well, she was one of the other panelists. And Blair has resold it to Canada's Game Show Network. And now I'm getting from Canada fan mail from his show I did up there in the 90s. So I'm in a really good position. So with all of my life, because of my background, which I don't want to go into much anymore, I have had to climb personally and professionally a lot of mountains, and most of them were the size of Everest, okay? So in the business, I'm considered over the hill. But in my life, I know in that respect, I'm over the hill, but I'm going to climb the next hill when I turn 90. I just hope it's a molehill. I just hope it isn't Everest. So that was the reason for part of my delay, and maybe because I didn't want to do any show for, I didn't want to do anything for 3 months. And you know, I have not missed doing anything related to show business in 40 years. Mm-hmm. Not one day. I'm always doing something. And I especially love doing your show because it's totally non-scripted and ad-libbed, and we have the greatest time.
Yes, we do. And people out there do, too, around the world. Lots and lots of people. And
well,
as far as I'm concerned, if you do this program for another 20 years and you end up doing it on an IV drip in a hospital, we should continue doing it.
Well, the thing is,
I want to hear the nurse jokes. All right.
Okay, so I got official word the other day that I was old. Did you know that?
Oh, tell me more.
I went into the grocery store, Albertsons, a large grocery store, which I frequent often. I always wear my Superman sweater.
I was going to ask you.
I'm wearing it. Well, I wear it for a couple of reasons. My son loved it. It was good luck. But you know what, Jeff? It makes people smile when they see it. Okay, so.
Does, I'm sure. I can see it right now. Absolutely.
Yeah, especially when they see a guy with gray hair. Okay. So anyway, I buy a loaf of bread, and I get to the counter, and I pay for the loaf of bread, and I pick it up. And I said, you don't have to put it in a bag. A very attractive young lady there. And then she says, does Superman need help to the car?
Funny.
Carrying the bread.
That's funny.
So I said, yes, what time do you get off? So
all
she
right.
goes, okay,
That's
so
cute.
She, goes,
That's
she
cute.
Goes back. She goes back to work tomorrow. So, in any event,
yeah.
When I got this show, surprisingly, on Channel 9, and mm-hmm. it has some of the greatest guests: John Voight, Anthony Quinn, oh my God, Ricardo Montalban, Ned Beatty, Richard Roundtree. I mean, all kinds of great stars. Now, quick word about, I said I was going to say something about Burt Reynolds, is I got a call from a lady last week. Her name's Maggie. She's doing a documentary in Florida about Burt Reynolds, which, of course, is where Burt lived. And she said she's looked at over 500 hours of Burt's interviews, and not one comes close to the one that I have in my pilot or that's on my website with Brian Gumbel. And she said, I need 43 seconds of it. How much would you charge me? It's a very low budget show. How much would you charge me? And I don't know where this figure comes from. And I just said, well, look, I'll give it to you for $1,500. The truth is, I would have given it to her for nothing, you know, because she was so nice. But I said, $1,500. She said, I'll PayPal you the money right away. I got the money right away, $1,500. And so it's going to be in that documentary. But, you know, when I got the show on Channel 9, I got a call from Ricardo Montalban. And Ricardo Montalban, Jeff, is the only person I ever had to apologize to for a review that I did. Did you know that?
I don't think you've ever told me that.
I have never. The reason Burt Reynolds showed up is because I bombed him in White Lightning. And he called and he said, what
that
time?
I remember. Did tell me that.
Yeah, so he showed up. And it, even in my introduction to him, I said there's a lot of times I didn't like his work except here. So that's what made it such a wonderful. And, you know, after he never left the show, he sat next to Brian Gumbel for the whole show. Then he continued to write me. He never typed anything. In the book that Carol Hoenig did called The Greatest Reviews I Ever Read, Sarita had found those handwritten notes from Burt Reynolds to me and my typed notes back to him. And they're in that book. I mean, and they're absolute treasures. Anyway, I get a call from Ricardo Montalban. And he said, again, a very elegant, Mr. Barber, he says, would you have room for me to be one of your guests live on one of your shows?
Wow, how nice. That's
and
nice.
I said, well, you'll see how nervous I was. I said, Mr. Montalban, are you sure you want to come on this show? He said, yes, you are one of my favorite people. And when I get there, I will tell you why. So anyway, he shows up, and my God, the wonderful, wonderful stories he tells. And I'll tell you a great story that Anthony Quinn told that he never told anyone. Anyway, he's so charming. And I finally, and very funny, because he hated the fact he was always playing this romantic character off his, right. off his
yeah.
planet.
Latin lover. Okay.
Yeah. He said the best part he ever had, I think, was in a Star Wars episode or Star Trek episode where he played the villain. He said it was my favorite moment in American television or American movies. And then I said to him, you know, Mr. Montalban, I cannot thank you enough. I could never have called you. I would not have had the courage to call you to come on the show because I was ashamed. And I was sure that you would cuss at me in Mexican and Spanish and any other language that you know.
Right.
He started to laugh. And he said, you know, Mr. Barber again, and it's on tape. He said, you're like the grass between the cracks on the sidewalk. No matter how many times they cut you down, you keep growing up someplace else. One of my favorite people in town. I just love watching you resurface. And so.
Well, those are those mountains you climb, John. And
yeah.
That's the truth. For those of you who don't know much about John, John has earned every iota of fame and respect that he has, which is gargantuan. He has been through hell and high water many times and never has turned away from the task and the goal. Never. Go ahead.
Okay, so. Anyway, Mr. Montalban, and he said, Ricardo, I said, I can't call you that, sir. I said, I have to call you that because I want to apologize to you. He said, what on earth would you apologize to me for? I said, you were in the King and I at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And he said, yes, I remember that. And I said, one line of my review was that the performance was so wooden, you couldn't tell where the stage ended and Ricardo Montalban began. Well, he howled. And I said, so I have to apologize to you. And then I said, then he said, he leaned forward and he was ever so sweet. And he said, I know, John, now he calls me John, I know, John, that you didn't mean to be vicious. And then I said, but I did. He said, okay, now it's my turn to be mean. And that's how it ended. He howled and grabbed my hand. Now I'm going to tell you one interesting story about Anthony Quinn.
Yeah.
And Anthony Quinn never told this story ever. Anthony Quinn never wanted to be an actor. Did you know that?
No.
No, he wanted to be an architect. That was his main dream, was to be an architect. He's Irish, you know. He's not Mexican. He's Irish. But he lived in the Mexican neighborhood. They were rather poor.
Right.
And he hated the sight of poor buildings, and he wanted to design beautiful buildings where people could live and work.
Huh.
So he went to school to be an architect. And he had, Frank Lloyd Wright was holding a contest, and he sent his material to Frank Lloyd Wright, and Frank Lloyd Wright called him and invited him to the office and sat him down and talked to him for a while and said, your drawings, Mr. Quinn, are absolutely magnificent, but you'll never be able to be an architect. And Anthony Quinn said, why, sir, why? He said, because you don't know how to talk. And that was a rude thing to say. And the truth was that Anthony Quinn had a cleft tongue when he was a youngster.
No kidding.
He couldn't talk. Yeah. And so here's what Frank Lloyd Wright did. I am going to send you to the best hospitals in Los Angeles, and they're going to fix your mouth. And your tongue. which he did. And then when he got out and came back to see him, and now he could speak a little, he said, now I'm going to pay to send you the greatest drama school in Los Angeles. So he went to the drama school and never saw Frank Lloyd Wright again. And that's how it started.
Incredible. What a story.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, a friend, one of the guys that found this material has thousands of hours of old shows. And what he does, he sells minutes from these old shows. He has every Merv Griffin show, Michael Douglas show. He has all of these, and he will sell 2 or 3 minutes for $5,000 to $10,000. He has taken some of these interviews that I have, and he said, John, I'm going to start making you some money because these are classics. And that Quinn story, somebody's going to do a documentary about Anthony Quinn, and for that story alone, they'll pay you $10,000. And I said, well, how much of the 10 do I get? He said, I get 5 and you get 5. And I said, oh, my goodness, that's just wonderful. Now, the thing that I guess I wanted to tell you, isn't it funny how I wanted to get to this right away because you sort of billboarded that I might be talking about this. But, you know, of all the wonderful people that have read my book and they send questions or on the Internet or Facebook, they ask questions. They ask questions, of course, about a Garrison. They ask a lot about Burt Reynolds, and they ask most about Sinatra and Red Fox. But you know who they ask the most about? Hey.
About you.
No, they don't ask about me. They know about me from the book. They ask about Chuck Barris.
Oh, God. That's right. Now, for all of you out there, please go to guests. You know where the banner is. Click on that and look under John's name because it says photos. And I want you to take a look at some of those pictures. They're phenomenal, and they tie right into what he's going to tell us.
Well, 8 months ago, it was up on YouTube, my half hour that I hosted the Gong Show, and I was in this beautiful white suit, and I put it up along with any show that you pick that Chuck Barris had done, and I had my audience vote to see who would have been the better host of the Gong Show. It was almost unanimous that it would be me. But, of course, these are my fans. And the owners of the show took my half hour down so nobody could ever see it again. But what I would like to do, since I get so many questions about it, even the very famous actor who made a movie out of Chuck Barris's book, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, called me and wanted to know if he could use a clip from when I did the show. And I said, no, I want nothing. He's one of the most famous actors in the world. And I told him no. But if you find out who produced and directed Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, that's a guy that I said no to because I want nothing to do with Chuck Barris. So what I would like to do, if you don't mind, so that you can rest for 15 or 20 minutes. Hopefully I can read it that fast.
Yeah,
and then you and I can talk about it afterwards. It's only because I tell this to people who buy the book. You don't have to read it from front page to back page.
Right.
If you're interested in Sinatra or Lucille Ball or anybody, just you look it up in the front because it's written like a collection of newspaper articles. There's not one chapter. Just go to the Gong Show, 4.5 pages, and it's a great read. I hope it's a great read.
Okay, go to it. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Johnny Barber. I knew the distinctive happy voice immediately when I answered the phone on an early afternoon in 1976. Chuck Barris, I said flatly. Johnny, I got something I'd like to show you, a TV clip. It's only about 10 minutes long. Do you think you could drop by my office on Vine Street later today in a couple of hours? Chuck's office was in a large ABC studio complex south of Sunset Boulevard. At the time, Chuck was the most important and recognizable producer of game shows and television, two of them being The Dating Game and The Newlywed Game. They made a fortune for him and ABC. He wasn't well known for being on the air himself, but for his amazing ability to get publicity promoting himself and his shows. In person, you could see why people liked him. He greeted me with a huge grin and a handshake, almost pulling me into his office. "I've been looking for weeks for someone, and you're right here on it, right under my nose, Johnny." "Johnny, this is Chris Beard. This is the co-producer of this thing." Chuck led me to a seat in front of a large TV screen so quickly I had no time to shake hands with Chris. His hello was a grunt anyway and a nod. Chuck picked up the TV remote. "This is an Australian talent show of sorts. It's a huge hit down under. I bought the rights and sold it to NBC. It's called The Gong Show." He played the short tape. It was charming and at times funny. The host, after a brief introduction, would bring on the performers, nearly all of whom were obviously untalented or unprofessional. A minute into their acts, a panel of three judges would grab a huge mallet and whack a big gong. It reminded me of the opening of those J. Arthur Rank movies from England. Chuck laughed with delight, clapping his hands with each gong. When it was over, he turned to me. "What do you think?" "Well, it's kind of funny, but it's a little cruel." "That's the idea, like a car wreck. You can't take your eyes off it. It's a cinch." "Well, Chuck, you would know, but why are you showing it to me?" "I want you to host it. You're the perfect host." "You're kidding." "No, I'm not. You're the only one I've been considering. What do you think?" "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" "There was no performer, Chuck, in that clip who had talent. So, well, to just bang one bad act after another, frankly, to me is cruel and predictable. How would you tweak the show?" "And what you showed me, Chuck, the host never talked to the contestants. He just introduced them. If he had chatted with them for just a minute to find out a little about them, then the audience would have a little more sympathy for them, as would the judges, making it a little harder to gong them."
"You bet.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Agreed. And you're great with people. I have no problem with that. So would you consider doing it?" "Can I consider it for a bit?" "Not too long. NBC's hot to trot." I informed Chuck of my unpleasant experience with Connections, a game show at ABC, and why I turned it down. "Johnny," said, "this is not a talk show. It's a talent show, or rather a no-talent show. But I agree, learning a little more about the people would make them people. Call me in the morning. If it's a yes, you'll get $3,500 a show, 10 times what you make as a critic, and you can keep your critic's job. I'll arrange for you to have lunch at the Beverly Hills Hotel with my business manager. You'll love him. Used to do PR for Sinatra. And sign the deal, okay?" "Thank you. I appreciate your interest in me, and I'll call you one way or the other early." The money had nothing to do with my saying yes to a delighted Chuck the next morning. I could keep my critic's job. The studio was downstairs, 5 minutes away. On a national level, it would give me a chance, even though a short one, to talk to people, real people, which I enjoyed. At noon, I was at the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel, sitting across from Chuck's business manager. Wow. He was almost 50, with an appealing world weariness about him, especially when I got him to talk about show business. He had seen it all and been impressed by none of it, except by a brief meeting with a down-and-out Frank Sinatra. "Yeah, about 25 years ago, I was a kid myself," he started slowly remembering. "But I was one of this town's PR hotshots. I got a call from Sinatra, whom I didn't know. He was almost out of the business. He asked if I would meet with him. I said, sure. I mean, he was on his ass. Ava had left him. MGM had dropped him. Even Columbia Records. For a time, he even lost his voice, couldn't use it for 6 months. There were rumors he was going to stick his head in a gas oven, so we met for lunch. He matter-of-factly told me how shitty things were for him, but now that his voice felt better, he wanted to try and start over. To do that, he said, he needed more than ever. He needed a great PR guy. He needed me and asked if I would do it. Of course, I felt sorry for the guy. I mean, what a star.
Right.
And what a fall. I told him I would, and that I'd only charge him half my fee. He cussed me like I'd never been cussed before. He got pissed. He said, I don't want charity. I want the best, and I want the best, and I'll obey whatever your fee is, full load. And he did it. Did. Never missed a payment. And the rest, as they say, is history. And wow. I said, are you friends with him now? No, once in a while he drops me a note. In this town, success, like failure, makes people grow apart. I just send a thank you note. Why did you get out of the PR business? I loved listening to him. He smiled broadly. Movie stars, egos, they're the worst. So how do you feel about the Gong Show? Are you excited? It's different. I'm pleased for the chance, but excited, it's not the right word. That's the perfect attitude. The only thing in this town that is definite is disappointment. Success is a surprise, he said. No matter how it goes, though, with this show, and Chuck, believe me, it'll be a great experience. He looked at me as though he wanted to tell me something else, but held back. Okay, he said, sign this and let's go to work. The three celebrity judges for the run-through rehearsals and the first pilot were J.P. Morgan, Jimmy Farr from MASH, and Artie Johnson from Laugh-In. They were perfect and supportive. For me, though, the run-throughs were uncomfortable. It was difficult for me to make my kind of real contact with the contestants, asking just a few background questions. As I feared, as we went along, Chuck wanted my already brief questions cut down or eliminated, reducing me once again to a traffic cop. This time a traffic cop who enjoyed watching people crash. NBC was also feeling uncomfortable with me in the show. There was never a talent show on TV that was deliberately set up to bash and make fun of the untalented. In the days of radio on the Major Reeves Amateur Hour, where Sinatra got his start as part of the Hoboken Four, in a rare instance, a hook was brought out and a gong banged to remove an act that shouldn't have been there in the first place. The audience always laughed, but it was a very rare occurrence. On this show on TV for the first time, they'd be gonged and gone every few minutes. At the end of the awkward first pilot's taping, the very tough, attractive head of daytiming programming stopped everything and called Chuck aside. She thrust a piece of paper at him. After looking at it in a brief, tense discussion, Chuck walked over and handed it to me. This is how she wants you to introduce the show before you introduce the guests. Go over it and let's do it again. I looked at it. It said nothing to the effect that the guests had been warned about what may happen to them as a result of their appearance. I was appalled and motioned to Chuck. Chuck, this is awful. What she wants you to do, in essence, is apologize beforehand for the show. There are better ways to say it. You can say something like, all of us have talent, some of us more than others, and they'd like that talent to be shared and seen. This is a show that provides them that stage. And as you'll see, some of them have more talent than others. Say it like that in a different kind of way. John, we have to give the lady what she wants. Here, say it. He took the paper from my hand and, as he did frequently, demonstrated how to perform it. He was doing something he wanted to do, be the Jewish Ed Sullivan. In the final taping of that pilot, my discomfort saying these apologetic words and not being able to get to know the guests was evident. I was not right for this show. It came as no surprise and maybe a little relief when a few hours later, the business manager handed me a check for $17,500, my fee for the first five shows. Chuck's going to host the show, he said. I liked what you had to say, but I have to say, Chuck has no hard feelings. I said, Chuck has five shows to tape, right? Would he mind if I asked him something? Chuck appeared, smiling and bubbly as usual. He said, I'm sorry it didn't work out, but I'm putting together a gift for you. I held up the check. Chuck, are you a betting man? Sometimes, depends. Why? You have five shows to tape. I'll make you this bet. Let me host just one show my way. You do the other four shows your way and her way. I'll bet this $17,500 that my way will be better, and you and she can be the judge. He stared at me. The first time I saw him without a smile. It's out of my hands now, too late, but you'll still get your gift. The Gong Show went on to become an enormous hit, Chuck's way, proving, as H.L. Mencken said, no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people. I only watched it a couple of times when my once-upon-a-time friend Murray Langston appeared as the unknown comic. It was funny. The gift Chuck gave me was a large trophy with a gong mounted on it and a warm inscription from him indicating I was the first person gonged. I keep it on my desk. A decade or so after the last episode aired, efforts were made to remount it. They all failed. Perhaps what really made it work and what they now didn't have was Chuck. Like a number of successful performers and producers in this business, success had gone early to Chuck Barris's nose. That was why he was all so bubbly when I saw him. I was never for an instant sorry I didn't do the Gong Show or adapt to it. Making $17,500 a week meant absolutely nothing to me. I was still doing my reviews, $350 a week. When I lost the AM show, though, which was only local, and I only got paid $1,000 a week, I was devastated. It was a meaningful show. The anger at the thoughtlessness, incompetence of KABC's management still resonates with me after all these years. I see that incompetence spreading through the media in America like a tsunami now, drowning us. I am often asked, still, what I think of Chuck's autobiographical book, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, in which he claims to have been a hitman for the CIA. All I say is that I interviewed, and you see it on my site, a soldier, John Gibran, who was a hitman for the CIA. And after he went public, proving it on my show, the government dragged him off to a mental ward. They did not drag off Chuck Barris to one. He died of natural causes in France at the age of 87. End of story.
Wow. That's almost a major motion picture, as you just described. That's extraordinary. And your comment about Chuck's nose really rings today very clearly when one thinks of Volodymyr Zelensky. It's the same kind of thing. Little guy, big nose, lots of snow. And that was a Coke-propelled success, that program. Ever bubbly, effervescent Chuck Barris.
You know, when we were really, really close to Red Fox, which is all of his life, actually, less close toward the end, though, because he had to go to a hospital a half a dozen times to get his nose fixed because of the amount of cocaine he snorted. But you know, when he was at NBC doing Sanford and Son, if you went down there that one time of the month, you would see 12 to 15 executives in blue suits and black suits collecting their cocaine from Red Fox. And if you see some pictures of Red Fox, you'll see a necklace where he had red dice. But those red dice were hollow. What was inside that shows the number 674 was cocaine. That's where he kept it. And Sarita, so perceptive and so smart, when she did a wonderful article for LA Magazine, first up, put black on the cover. Now, I told you the story about how she got red on the cover, but she had a number of people she called big, big stars. All of them just were wonderful. All of them wonderful. Biggest in the business. Talking about the small side businesses that they had. Not great businesses, but the fun side business. Yeah. And Red had a hair salon. And
we got, John, we have about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, God. Anyway, she managed his hair salon on Sunset Boulevard, and a guy came in with a big box and handed it to Sarita and said, "This is for Mr. Fox." And she threw it back at him. And you said, "You take that out of here." And what it was a box of cocaine. They were trying to set him up. They weren't delivering. They were trying to set him up.
Wow.
What? My God, there goes time flies.
Yes, always does. Always does. We will. Let's pick this up next month and spend a little more time on Red and whatever. We always have fun. And the people out there really care about you. You need to keep that in mind.
Well, I care about you, Jeff, because I wouldn't have a lot of this without you. And there would have been no real people without Sarita, you know. So
yeah, well.
I'm agnostic, but I do believe there is something that at work in the universe, and it often worked in my favor.
I agree. Give Sarita a hug for me, Johnny, and I'll talk to you next month.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Good night. The one and only, truly an extraordinary human being, a great man, John Barber. And have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back Monday.